From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we explore the history of the norm of concession in presidential races. Then we hear about an art exhibit that combines the writings of trauma survivors with landscape paintings.
One of the things that a participant said last year, and it captured exactly what we were going for, is she said that these paintings are a tangible representation of who we are as thrivers on this journey from victim to survivor to thriver.
Plus, we explore the creation of an NES video game set here in Milwaukee.
I just started chipping away at it, and slowly but surely, you know, I was able to come out of the other end with a fully formed video game that, you know, is playable on an NES cartridge.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Throughout the history of our nation, outgoing presidential candidates have set aside party differences to accept the results of elections, even contentious ones. President Donald Trump, so far, still has not conceded to President-elect Joe Biden and continues to fight the results of the election. Trump and Vice President Pence have failed to say that they'll accept the will of the voters. The president even began making those statements months before people went to the polls. In light of this breaking of political norms, David Preece wanted to revisit other contentious election results in an article that he wrote for the Lawfare Institute. From just before the Civil War to Hillary Clinton's concession, some of the elections Preece revisits had the potential to create more damage than simply dividing the country. He joins me now to explain more about our country's powerful norm of accepting election results. David Preece, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks so much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So much like many of our traditions surrounding elections in this country, the peaceful transition of power is a norm, not a law written into the Constitution, correct?
That's right. It is assumed in the Constitution that a duly elected president will take the oath of office and assume the powers and duties of the office, and the previous occupant of the office will go along his or her merry way. But there's nothing that actually states that a losing candidate has to concede the election or make a statement acknowledging defeat. It's just supposed to happen.
So, of course, this brings us to today, where both Vice President Mike Pence and especially President Donald Trump have avoided a commitment to accept the election's results since even before, you know, ballots were cast. So why are we still surprised, I guess?
Yeah, this president, regardless of how you feel about his policies or his mannerisms, the one thing everyone acknowledges is he has been all too willing and perhaps even eager to reject traditions and norms involving the presidency. And there are too many of them to count, but the one at stake now appears to be the longstanding norm of presidential candidates who, even after bitter election fights, accept the results of contentious elections. And they, at least since the late 19th century, they've even made statements to that point, whether by telegram, whether in phone calls to the winning candidate, and then often in public speeches or statements in which they say the words often, "I accept the results of the voters," or "I acknowledge that my opponent has beaten me." And then they almost always put in nice words about supporting them and helping them to benefit the nation. But it is a very longstanding norm that we do not lose at the ballot box and then turn to violence in the streets as a second step. We just haven't done that here, unlike many countries.
Right. And as you noted, Trump's behavior throughout his first campaign and into his presidency always touted the so-called benefit of being an outsider politician, right? But what surprises me is other incumbent Republican Party members, you know, such as Pence, who has been within this system for a very long time, and other senators who are also going along with not committing to a peaceful transition or accepting the results of the election. So where do you see other Republicans playing a role in getting the Trump administration to honor the norm of peaceful transfers of power?
Yeah, that's the variable here that's seemingly hard to explain, although I think there is some logic behind it. It may not be good for the country as a whole. The point is, during an election, you go at it. You fight over the issues, you fight over the policies. But then when the election is done, you come together and say, okay, now we have to get on with the business of governing for the American people. And we'll continue to disagree about policies and we can veto things and overrule things. That's fine. But let's come together and at least accept that we are all in our duly elected positions. What you're seeing now, however, is you see some Republican officials who, if not supporting the president's attempts to litigate left and right to try to change results in various states, at least are saying silent on his claims that he has somehow won the election. That is a weird variable because we generally don't see that. From a governance perspective, that is obviously dangerous. From a personal political perspective, however, I'm not so sure it should be a surprise because many of these officials, whether senators or representatives, are in very safe districts or in very safe states where they have been reelected quite easily, whether because of gerrymandered districts in House cases or just because of the political population in the state for Senate races. And if they just found out in their last election, which for representatives was all this most recent election, and for some senators was, if you're Lindsey Graham and you ran for reelection in South Carolina, and it was a very contentious race, and all of the negatives that came with supporting Donald Trump to the extent that he has were out in the open, and the voters still voted for you, I'm not sure there's a high political cost to giving Donald Trump a few days, a few weeks, or even more of entertaining his delusions about still being president. It's toxic, but I'm not sure it's really surprising for some individual lawmakers to do this. What I contrast with that, Audrey, is if you look at what some state and local officials are saying, it's quite interesting. Even in a state like Montana, which had a vote overwhelmingly for Donald Trump, the Republican Secretary of State, who has been a Trump supporter, tweeted that, "Mr. President, I've supported you. We've supported you. We like what you've done, but it is time to bite your lip and step aside. You're done." That's an interesting difference between what you're seeing at the national level, offices elected to national office, and what you're seeing at offices at the state and local level. That could prove to be an interesting variable in the days going forward.
Right. So in light of this situation, you thought it was worth highlighting how strong of a norm concession of power truly is in an article you wrote on previous contentious presidential elections. And this, of course, ranges from Stephen Douglas upon Abraham Lincoln's win as the country was literally on the brink of literal bloodshed and a civil war over slavery and succession, from Teddy Roosevelt in the 1912 election, where he was shot right here in Milwaukee before making a campaign speech. And of course, one election that's come up a lot in comparing and contrasting is the 2000 election with Al Gore after a protracted recount and a legal battle. But it's two other presidential contests that you say are even more significant, the elections of 1824 and 1876. So can you explain what happened for the election of 1824 and more specifically what happened to Andrew Jackson?
You bet. These are the two elections I highlighted because they were probably the most contentious, and they were the ones in which the losing candidates had a completely legitimate gripe about the process and the way it happened. So in 1824, things were a little bit different then, and there were actually several leading presidential candidates, not just two, and they split the electoral votes such that there was no winner, and the decision on who would be the next president went to the House of Representatives in a vote by which, due to our arcane method, the House of Representatives delegations would vote by state, not by individual member. Well, it turns out that Henry Clay, a very prominent American back then who ran repeatedly for the presidency but never quite made it, he finished fourth place in the balloting. So he was not even in consideration. The House only would consider the top three choices. But Henry Clay was very powerful in Congress, and he ended up swaying some of the state's delegations to actually vote for John Quincy Adams, enabling him to become president, even though Andrew Jackson had won what was then a very small popular vote, because we did not have the full vote for many, many people in America. But he even had more electoral votes, and yet he lost. And this is the kind of thing that Andrew Jackson, a man of much passion and ire, probably could have taken to the streets and gotten his supporters to use violence. But he definitively did not. He actually stepped back and said he did not want to get in the way of the pure principles of our institutions. And he lived to fight another day, and he certainly did. In 1828, he came back with a vengeance and won decisively.
You note in your article that Jackson had a cult-like personal popularity within America, but he used that influence for the better. You know, ultimately, country mattered more than party. Do you think Trump could have the same effect if he accepted and worked towards a peaceful transition?
He could, but it would be difficult. And here's why. Andrew Jackson, with all of his faults, and he had them, he had been a career military officer. He had served in the government before. He was definitely invested in the institutions of power. Sure, he wanted to do some things that previous presidents hadn't. He wanted to change precedent for many things, including having a populist leader, which was not the American norm. But ultimately, he was a patriot. He was an institutionalist who put the country above personal interests. Many people would not say the same about Donald Trump. Donald Trump had not served in the military, in fact, had avoided military service, had not served in a government position before, and made his way to power by trying to tear down the institutions that he would be in control of in the executive branch. Kind of hard to pivot away from that. Kind of hard to suddenly say, now I am in favor of all these institutions, and I want all of my followers to love the so-called deep state, and the blob in Washington is great. I don't think it would actually resonate well with people he has agitated for some 5 years now. I would like to see it anyway. I do think it would be good for the American system for everyone to realize that democracy matters more than any individual result. But I'm not convinced that the dynamics behind Trump's rise to power can that easily be switched off.
You're listening to Lake Effect, and I'm speaking with David Preece. He wrote an article for the Lawfare Institute on the powerful norm of accepting the results of a presidential election. So let's go to the election of 1876, and what was kind of a complicated outcome, to say the least. And also of note was the first large-scale printing and mailer campaigning effort by Samuel Tilden. So this record still stands today. 82% of eligible voters turned out in favor of Tilden, yet he didn't win. Can you explain this election?
Yeah, this one was a mess, and whole books have been written about this that try to explain it. But to put it simply, we don't know the names Samuel Tilden and Rutherford B. Hayes very well, in part because this election was such a mess and America wanted to move past it and do better. Rutherford B. Hayes was the Republican candidate, Samuel Tilden the Democratic candidate, and Tilden had a reformist, anti-corruption platform behind him, which was very popular at the time, and he won what was the popular vote, and he appeared to win the electoral vote. But there were three states that were very close. And in fact, they had institutions in the state government that were controlled by Republicans. And literally overnight on election night, they decided, let's try to turn these back. Let's try to discount ballots from Democratic districts and bolster votes from Republican districts so that we can actually get an electoral vote to the Congress that shows that these states went to Republicans. And it was a long process. It was an ugly process. It went right up to almost Inauguration Day. Ultimately, what happened is these states sent in competing electoral votes. Different institutions of the state government sent in different tallies of the electoral vote to Congress. And Congress, you can picture the representatives and senators scratching their heads. They had to decide which slate of electors to count in the vote. Ultimately, they nominated a commission to look into this, and it ruled very narrowly in favor of the Republican, Rutherford B. Hayes, in every case, handing the presidency to him. Now, Samuel Tilden was very passive in this process. He was not seeking to use violence. In fact, there were cries across America, Tilden or blood. many of his supporters wanted to use force to take the office that they thought was rightfully his, but he dampened that and he told his supporters no, again, essentially saying the institutions and the country matter more than this particular fight. And we avoided what very likely could have been a second civil war within 20 years because of the results of this disputed election. What's interesting about these cases, Audrey, is these are all cases where these were people running for the presidency, but they were not incumbents. These were people who did not have the trappings and power of the office. Now, we have had incumbents who have run and lost. It doesn't happen that much lately, but we had George H.W. Bush in 1992, who was president and lost to Bill Clinton. We had Jimmy Carter in 1980, who ran against Gerald Ford and won and kicked Ford out of the Oval Office. And you can go back to Herbert Hoover getting kicked out by Franklin Roosevelt. In those cases, it's even harder because the sitting president knows what it's like to be president. They have their policies in train. They want to keep doing them. But in all of those cases, the presidents made very gracious concession speeches. George H.W. Bush talked about the majesty of American democracy. All of them pledged to give their full support in the transition to make the future administration the best in history. That's the kind of thing that incumbents in our country have done when they've lost the election. That's what we'd hoped that this president would do, but it does not seem to be in the nature of the person.
So even between now and January, if large-scale violence and protests can be avoided through a concession speech or accepting the results finally, you know, what damage has already been done? We just had a man arrested in New York City Tuesday facing federal charges after he allegedly made death threats against people celebrating President-elect Joe Biden. So we're seeing small acts, you know, individually, but not large scale.
No, thankfully, we haven't seen any large scale act. And that's my source of optimism here, is we do have a very inflamed electorate. We do have many people who feel passionate on all sides of this. And yet in a country of 330 plus million people, we have not seen sustained violence. We have seen only very anecdotal cases where people are going too far. That's obviously a good thing, but I do have a slight element of fear that the longer the president goes without conceding, without formally acknowledging the result and accepting that he will not be president, the more danger there is. And there's really two reasons for this. The first is that it doesn't enable a smooth transition. And it may seem like January is a long way away, but we've only got just over 60 days until a whole new government is running and executing the policies of the United States. And that's not a long time to get people's security clearances approved, to get people into offices, to get them reviewing the existing policies and considerations that led to them, so that when the oath of office is taken, the president and those around him can make effective decisions. The second reason is that bigger societal reason, is that many countries around the world experience street battles and even civil wars after contentious elections. That is not unusual. It's very unusual for us, such that even talking about it seems strange. But the United States of America is the exception rather than the rule in this case. And much of the credit for this actually goes to losing presidential candidates who, for the greater good, have communicated their acceptance of outcomes they didn't like and didn't agree with. The concession speech means nothing legally, but it means a whole lot for the health of the country.
David Pries is the chief operating officer of the Lawfare Institute. He has also served during the Bill Clinton and George W. Bush administrations as a CIA officer. You can find a link to his Lawfare article on the norm of conceding in presidential elections and listen to our full conversation at WUWM.com. Coming up, we learn about a new exhibit transforming trauma into art. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Living with trauma and injustice is undoubtedly difficult. Those living with these experiences find different ways of overcoming them, and one way is through art and writing. That's what the Milwaukee exhibit Rise and Thrive, a Lives and Landscape series, is all about. In its second year, the exhibit combines survivors' stories with landscape paintings. Visual artist Brianna Seipel collaborated with the Thriver writers to create corresponding landscapes for each essay. And new this year, filmmaker Michael Snowden documented the creation of the paintings and will overlay the film with audio recordings of the essays. Seipel, along with self-proclaimed Thriver and public speaker Lisa McCormick, and Lotus Legal Clinic Interim Executive Director Kate Knowlton, all spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about the exhibit.
Can you all tell me a little bit about this year's show?
Yeah, so this is the second year of Rise and Thrive. It started last year. I've been working with Lotus Legal Clinic in a variety of ways for the last about 6 years. And I had this idea. Personal work is about exploring our connection to the outdoors and the power of wild spaces to heal, inspire, and transform our lives. So I'm really interested in how landscapes shape our identity and how we can explore our personal stories through art. And so I approached Lotus last year with this idea to say, what would it be like if I worked with alumni of their creative writing program? To reapproach their stories in a new light, and that would be one of stories of healing and transformation through this lens of the outdoors. So Lotus said yes to that idea, and I worked with 6 participants last year. They all chose a landscape that was personally meaningful, and then they wrote a story to go along with that, and then in return, I create an oil painting of that place in the natural world, and they receive that as a gift with no cost to them other than their time participating in the project. One of the things that a participant said last year, and it captured exactly what we were going for, is she said that these paintings are a tangible representation of who we are as thrivers on this journey from victim to survivor to thriver. And it's, you know, all of us go through experiences that we have to, you know, we share with others and we heal over time. And it was just a really beautiful metaphor, and exactly what we were hoping that this project would accomplish is really honoring the stories of remarkable human beings through the places that inspire them.
And Lisa, are you participating in this year's show? So can you tell me a little bit about your contribution to this show?
It was interesting process for us to pick a photo that we had taken. And so I had chosen a photo from a trip we went down to Mexico with my family. And my son absolutely loves to do take photos of sunrises and sunsets. And we were on the wrong side of the island wrong side of the country to do sunsets. And so we got up really early one morning and began taking sunrise photos. And it was right after a big storm the night before. And so the waves were just crashing like crazy. But, you know, my focus at the time was on the sunrise, not on the water. And until I started this project and really looked at the photo and trying to describe the photo to a reader who would not see the photo, you know, and to be able to describe exactly what you were seeing in that photo was a really amazing experience. And then to start putting metaphors to it was really eye-opening. I mean, it was really a cool experience. And I had told Brianna in this process that you know, when COVID hit, you know, I'm a public speaker. I travel all over the state and share my story. And when COVID hit, suddenly I had nothing to do. I was sitting at home and not out speaking anymore. And I really felt lost without a purpose or anything for me to be doing right now. And all of a sudden this project came up, and it really for me was gave me a purpose again and really kind of recentered me a little bit on what I was supposed to be doing and how something so simple as a sunrise and the storms were able to turn around and become, you know, give me complete new meaning and new purpose in what I was doing.
And Kate, can you tell me a little bit about Lotus, the organization, for those that don't know or are unfamiliar with it?
Lotus is a legal clinic. So Lotus Legal Clinic. But the uniqueness of us as a legal clinic is that we provide, all of our services are free of charge, and we provide direct representation to survivors of human trafficking, sexual violence, gender violence, and victim of crime. So along with that, we work heavily on the legal end of civil issues that otherwise might be overlooked, just because the way that our criminal system is designed in assisting victims is through the prosecution of their perpetrator. That's incredibly important. It's also completely grinding. It's super hard for prosecutors. It's definitely hard for their victim witness advocates and specialists, but it is really, really horrifically bad for survivors and victims. And it's narrow. So what Lotus tries to do is go in and not only make sure and support all the rights inside of that process, but also identify other civil legal assistance that we can provide on an expert level to make sure that this is not, because it is a defining moment. I get that. It's a defining moment of their life, but it does not, they can still be in control of how that definition moves them. And we want to help with that. We want to make sure they have all the professional resources they can to do that. So the beautiful part about Lotus is, in addition to those legal expertise, is we also have a survivor empowerment pillar, I guess is how I always think of it. Stepping outside of the legal processes and the civil representation we can do, Lotus is unique in being able to also provide those empowerment opportunities, in addition to the writing workshop and the Rise and Thrive experience, which is wholly Brianna. And we're so, so lucky. I can never express gratitude enough. But we also provide speaking engagements and provide support for survivors to participate in other ways that they identify, figure out additional opportunities to support them in their own career paths.
One really good example of that is that Lotus often takes the writing and the artwork created in their Untold Stories program to the Wisconsin State Capitol for Crime Victims Rights Week. And oftentimes survivors will accompany that artwork and speak in the Capitol Rotunda. So that's just an example of some of the platforms that Lotus provides to tell these stories. And I've often heard Austin say, Austin Reese, the director of Survivor Empowerment, that there are survivor empowerment programs, and taking these stories to the public are really about creating empathy and awareness one story at a time. And all of Lotus's programs are trauma-informed, so they have really this beautiful blend of acknowledging pain, but then creating something beautiful from it as well, and providing this platform to tell your story in an empowering way, because you choose how it's told and where it's told. It's just a really beautiful opportunity for alumni to reapproach their story, you know, years after going through the Untold Stories program, to be invited back by Lotus to say, where are you today? Tell us your story again. What can you share, you know, with the world about your experience now? So one thing that I want to kind of respond to that Lisa said too is that idea of co-creating in the middle of a pandemic. This program has been so powerful for me both last year, but particularly this year, because we don't have the opportunity to be together in person, and yet we're able to create this beautiful exhibit together virtually. And one of the things that really showcases that this year is that we had the ability to hire a filmmaker, Michael Snowden, who is really highlighting the co-creative aspect of this project. So he is taking footage of the paintings as I paint them, and then he is pairing that with audio recordings of each participant. So they're reading their work, and these films kind of marry those two pieces together. So you'll hear the participant reading their words and then the painting coming to life at the same time. And what's so beautiful to me about that is it shows how we're able to continue to work together even when we can't be together in person.
There's a clear empowerment message throughout Lotus, throughout Rise and Thrive. And so I wanted to ask, what is a thriver? And Lisa, for you in particular, how has your experience with these programs affected you, changed your life?
Well, I guess a thriver is a person who is more than a survivor. You have, I guess I look at it as, you sometimes are labeled as a victim first. You know, as a person who's been through something horrific. In my situation, my son Jeffrey was sex trafficked. And so as myself, it was what I went through as a parent of a child who'd been trafficked, but I also am a wife of a, or was a wife of a man who was very verbally abusive. So I know that life. And so I think for a long time I was a victim of that, and I didn't see myself as a survivor until many, many years later. I think I'm finally just starting to even feel as a survivor. But then when I went to this workshop, I learned about the word thriver, and I learned about that there's more than just surviving and just sometimes just being upright. There's a lot more to that. And being part of this project and hearing stories of these other women who have been through, you know, some incredible things as well. You know, it's a family. It's a network of people who I never probably would have met. I think a lot of my journey, I felt alone and didn't know other people went through this. You're now with a network of people who understand and know it's someone you can speak with and talk with and understand the journey with. So.
And did you ever see yourself as somebody who would be engaging in public speaking and telling so much of yourself to people you've never met before?
Well, I always say to everybody, God gave me the gift of gab, and I'm always a good talker. But I think as I was going through this journey, my son, Jeffrey, was really amazing at journaling and writing. And so him and I journaled this entire process together. And so I always knew we'd do something with it, whether write a book or have a blog or something. He had the dream to be able to speak to his senior class and tell them, stand on the stage and tell them I'm a recovering addict and I'm here to tell you, you know, all about my story. And he passed away his senior year of high school. And so, you know, that was never an opportunity. At 17, he passed away from a drug overdose, and he never got the opportunity to even try because of what these traffickers did. And so for him, I don't think we ever had the opportunity to do what our dreams were. So I am doing that for him. I am out there sharing, speaking, talking to anybody who will listen, and educate them on trafficking and tell our story. And if it helps one person, we've done our job.
I think that's so incredible that you all journaled your experience together. That's the kind of connection and time that most parent and children don't share. That journaling is usually such a solo activity.
Yeah, I guess, when he sat in a lot of hospitals, a lot of rehab clinics, a lot of jails and juvenile detention centers, and there's not much to do when you're sitting there 24/7. So for him, it was an outlet to write. He loved to draw and paint and take pictures. And so being able to connect his love for art in these projects to me is just another sign from him up above that this is what we're supposed to be doing.
That's incredible. What is the process like to create the piece of writing, to choose an image and bring these two things to life together?
Well, I'll speak on the writing part and Brianna can talk on the art side of it. But for me, I'm a new writer. I'm not a experienced writer like some of these other people I've met on this journey so far. But it really was fun. Like I said, putting metaphors to a picture was a very new experience, and being able to descriptively write was a lot of fun. I wanted to be a journalism major when I was in high school, so like I thought this would be, you know, this kind of up my alley. I always was good at writing papers and essays and that, so it's just kind of bringing that old writing skills back to life again. But for me, it was really kind of cool to write about it. And then we'd have, in this virtual world, we'd all come together and read our readings together in a forum. And then everyone would have an opportunity to say, well, I like this part, I don't like this part. And we'd kind of feed off each other. And it was really cool because there's a part in my writing where I talk about the ombre colors of the ocean. So from the navy blues to the turquoises to the clear waters. And, you know, to me, I'm just describing the water. And then somebody in the group said, well, you know, colors represent the healing. So the deep, dark navy blue is depression and sadness and grief. And as it turns to a lighter color, to almost clear, that's healing. And the clear colors show how you've come through this and you are thriving and you are, you know, so it kind of in the colors alone that describes your healing process. And I was just blown away. I'd never thought of that before. And I talked about waves crashing, like the difficulties in your life as the waves came crashing against my legs and knocking me over, or the water spraying in my face. To me, it was like what I was going through with my son, you know, and the difficulties would come and knock me over. And sometimes they'd, you know, startle me and scare me so much, you know. And so that's kind of the things I was looking at and making the whole water metaphor as something, as what's physically happening in my life. And you'll have to come to the event, see this event, so you can see all the rest of it. But
Brianna, what about for you?
Yeah, I can't describe this project has gone above and beyond what I dreamed it would be. Especially last year when we first started the program, we were really approaching people with a series of questions, some writing prompts, and really let them run with it. And I've been so blessed by the stories that have come out of it. I think when we're invited into a space, a safe space to explore our life stories, I think we, and then we're able to have a critique session, you know, with other writers. There's something really beautiful about that process, and it's been really neat to see. And really humbling to be the artist, you know, walking alongside these stories. And I was thinking about Lisa's painting the other day specifically, because what I love about her writing and the painting paired together is that it really brilliantly weaves together familiar sensations of wading into the ocean and being surprised by the strength of the waves and seeing a gorgeous sunrise that you can't take enough photos of and it still doesn't capture it fully. I think a lot of us have experienced that, you know. But at the same time, it tells a deeply personal narrative. And so what Lisa's work does so beautifully is it invites the viewer in initially through this beautiful visual and these familiar sensations. And then it you know, invites them to examine their own lives and to dive deeper into that metaphor. And that's what I love about this project as a whole, is that for the participants themselves, it's this beautiful opportunity to honor their stories. And then for the public, when, you know, through the exhibition and through the short films that we're creating, it's an opportunity to dig deeper and to build empathy and awareness for these stories. And I said to the filmmaker the other day, what's really cool about this as a visual artist, and for him as a filmmaker, is, you know, when we create a piece of art, it's a, you know, it has value in and of itself. But for me, these paintings are a beautiful object. And when you pair them with these incredible stories, they become so much more meaningful. So it's really thrilling as a visual artist to be working alongside these creative writers to tell these meaningful stories.
Visual artist Brianna Seipel, public speaker Lisa McCormick, and Lotus Legal Clinic interim director Kate Knowlton spoke with Lake Fex Becca Schimmel about their new exhibition. The Rise and Thrive, a Lives and Landscape exhibition, opens virtually on Saturday. The event and program is supported in part by a grant from the Wisconsin Arts Board with funds from the state of Wisconsin and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'll take one more break and then learn about a Wisconsin-based video game designed for Nintendo. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Lake Effect has launched a series called Pandemic Performers, where we're highlighting some of the work coming from Milwaukee artists, performers, and venues at a time when many of us are isolated. For Jordan Davis, the frontman of the Milwaukee-based band Space Raft, this time has been an opportunity to finish up a project he's been working on for 2.5 years. The band released 2 albums this summer, Positively Space Raft and its alter ego, Approximately Space Raft, which features chiptunes, the kind of music you'd hear in a video game, which naturally led Davis to designing his own. But it's not just any video game. It's a retro Nintendo game complete with 8-bit caricatures of the band and their trusty van. Davis spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about the process of creating that game.
So how did this idea begin in the first place?
I guess I would call it a joke first and foremost. I think at the outset of the idea, I just kind of thought it would be a funny thing to reproduce some of the music of the band in what's called chiptune, which is the type of audio that you would get from older hardware technology from the 70s and 80s. Anything from like an alarm clock to a beeper to a telephone to an old game console would have these sound chips inside of them, and making music for them is kind of a subset of music called chiptune. And it's a very limiting, stripped down type of computer music, I guess. And I thought producing music just for the band to hear would be kind of a funny thing that I could do. And I started producing these chiptunes, you know, just to share with the group, and everybody got a good laugh out of them. So I just kind of continued doing it. And then here we are.
Yeah, how do you go from that to actually building a video game?
Slowly. I mean, one step at a time. To be honest, I have no background in any sort of computer science or programming or anything. The idea for the project was the motivation for me to learn how to do just about everything to make this game happen. So really, once I had finished the soundtrack, I was like, how do I present this to people? Once I finished the album Positively Spacecraft, and once I had just transcribed it into chiptune, I had fun listening to it. My friends had fun listening to it, but I had no idea how I could present that to the public. You know, maybe make a cute little video that I could, you know, share with people. That would be one idea. Or I could, you know, release it on a cassette tape or something that would be low impact. But I guess the more I thought about it, the more I kind of just convinced myself that I should make some sort of game that people can experience while hearing this stuff. And one thing led to another. I found a few podcasts about, you know, new software for the Nintendo Entertainment System, which is called NES Homebrew. That's like the scene that's connected to it. And I just started researching and, you know, I started practicing drawing pixel art and started researching game design and how, you know, level design and all of the different aspects that go into, you know, making a fully playable game. And then I just started chipping away at it. And slowly but surely, you know, I was able to come out of the other end with a fully formed video game that, you know, is playable on an NES cartridge.
Yeah, so here's a short clip of what we're talking about when we're talking about these chiptunes. So these songs correspond with an album you guys actually released. Was the idea to release the video game alongside the album?
The idea developed alongside of the post-production of the album. So as we were finishing it, as we were mixing it and mastering the album, which took a very long time because we were very picky on this one, As I was working on that, it just kind of, you know, formed as a thing in my head that I could do on my spare time. And then, not that I had intended for the timing to work out where the game was released, you know, and coinciding with the album, but the longer that I worked on it, the more it seemed like that should be the case. Because if I was going to take a career retrospective of Spacecraft, it would be a bit more daunting to develop that much music or pick which ones work the best. So therefore, I just kind of decided to narrow my scope to the recent album. And that actually made it a lot easier for me to kind of focus on what I wanted to do.
Yeah. So let's talk a bit about the aesthetic of the game, because I think in some ways it will look very familiar to people who are familiar with Nintendo, but also it's very unique to your group.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have never done anything like this before. I'm not really known as a visual artist. I've done a few posters, you know, concert posters for my bands or friends' bands over the years, but I'm not really somebody who's doing a lot of visual art for my music projects. So from there, just learning how to do pixel art in the first place, you know, especially with like 8-bit pixel art, is very limiting. The color palettes that you have to work with are very limiting. You have to kind of learn all of the limitations before you can start making anything for it. So in that case, what I had to do was do a lot of research and a lot of studying other games, games that I thought were pretty when I was, you know, a kid, games that I thought were pretty now looking at them as an adult, you know, trying to narrow down exactly what the kind of visual style that I wanted to use. And to be very honest, like my first baby steps into making pixel art were just copying images from things like Legend of Zelda and Donkey Kong, like that kind of approach, just so I could understand how these kind of classic figures were built and then learn how to deconstruct them and build my own, I guess. That was my strategy, I guess.
How would you describe the game for people who haven't seen it? And of course, we're talking on the radio, so people will have to go online to see it. But what does it look like?
Well, so it's a grab bag of gameplay styles. The game kind of starts out driving in our van, which is basically a nondescript white van, which is, you know, what we've been traveling in for the last, I don't know, 5 years or so. And it's an obstacle-based scrolling game. So if you could imagine side-scrolling games like Gradius or Excite Bike or anything that's kind of zipping along with a little vehicle, that would be how I would probably describe the beginning of the game. It was probably most inspired by a game called TNC Surf Design, which was a little game about skateboarding across a bridge. It was very basic, but it kind of presented the proper template that I was looking for to depict the van on the streets of Milwaukee, I guess. And then the second phase is more kind of like it's a top-down three-quarter perspective, probably close to what would be seen in something like Bomberman or The Legend of Zelda, which I guess would be the closest visual cues. And that is mainly like a kind of arcade-style gameplay where you're just, you know, looking to collect all the objects and pass the single-screen rounds.
Okay. And the four characters, they're the people in your band, right?
Yep, absolutely. TJ, John, Tyler, and then myself, Jordan.
What is the objective?
Well, the objective is to thwart our ex-bass player, Serini. The premise of the game is that he came back to town to steal the master tapes of the new record, which we have to chase him down and collect them before we can put our new record out. And that was actually a premise that was suggested by, you know, our good friend Serini. You know, I was telling him one day that I was feeling a little bit lost. I've got all of these assets put together to make this game, but I really don't know what the objective is, what I'm doing. And he basically just stopped me and said, look, here's the premise. I'll be the villain. Just just blame it all on me. And then that will be kind of us off and running. And that's exactly what I did. So, you know, our old bass player, Serini, is the villain of the game. He's basically just trying to thwart our progress without him because he's jealous.
So it all takes place here. What are some of the references that people here in Milwaukee might know?
Well, the visual references, I mean, my first goals that I set out to do when learning how to do pixel art was just to kind of draw things that I was already familiar with, stuff that I always thought that was iconic to the location where the game takes place. So one of the first things that I did was to draw the Cactus Club here in Milwaukee, because that was one of our favorite venues to play. And as well, like most of Spacecraft had worked at the Cactus Club at different periods. TJ and Tyler had been bartenders there. John and I had worked the door for many years. So it's a place that's near and dear to us. So just drawing the front steps, and I think most Milwaukee music fans would understand the significance of walking up those front steps into Cactus Club. So that was one of the very first things that I drew for the game. That, as well as some other record stores that we're fans of, like Rushmore Records, Acme Records, We've got other venues like High Dive. One of our favorite taverns in Bayview, Bernhardt's, is in the game as well. And it's got other locations across the state of Wisconsin as well. I'm originally from Green Bay, so I couldn't help putting in some of my hometown stuff there. You know, Jake's Pizza, which is my favorite pizza in the world. And, you know, some of my favorite people from the music scene are depicted as well. I think a lot of the personality of the game just comes from its setting here in Milwaukee and then in Wisconsin at large.
Yeah. So what's the plan for distribution? How are people going to engage with the game?
So right now I've actually got the game on Kickstarter. And basically that is just so that I can fund the physical production of the cartridges. There are a bunch of different ways that I'm offering the game. There are digital versions, which is basically just, you know, the ROM file that you can download and play in a emulator or, you know, any other computer program that can basically emulate the NES. And then I'm offering physical cartridges that you can play on your old, you know, NES hardware. Just, you know, hook it up to your TV. And, you know, because I'm mainly experienced with physical record production, cassette, you know, music, you know, physical music materials, and doing independent runs of records, cassettes, 7 inches, et cetera, you know, I thought that I could apply that towards cartridge production as well, which is kind of similar, but to buy all of the materials needed to make a game like this is a lot more expensive for me personally than it is to put out a record. So yeah, basically at the Kickstarter campaign, you can pre-order the cartridge. And then once I have all the parts in hand and are able to assemble my production run, I will ship it to your door.
Alrighty. So for all those people who still have a Nintendo, they can engage with the game that way.
Mm-hmm.
Jordan Davis is the lead singer and guitarist for Space Raft. He's also the creator of the Space Raft NES game, which features music from their new album, Approximately Space Raft, the chiptune version of their other album, Positively Space Raft. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in August. You can see a video of the game and some of the artwork at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Becca Schimmel and Joy Powers join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Jack Urbanis. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Emily Files and Angelina Moshe Salazar from the WUWM news team this week. We want to extend our biggest thanks to Lauren Sigvison, our digital producer who finished at the station this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can join us again Monday at 10 for Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.